Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. President Trump and North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un met face-to-face on Tuesday in Singapore. It was the first time that leaders of the two countries have met. Both signed a joint statement committing to denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Trump, though, caught military officials in the U.S. and South Korea off guard when he referred to so-called war games.
We will be stopping the war games, which will save us a tremendous amount of money, unless and until we see that the future negotiation is not going along like it should. But we'll be saving a tremendous amount of money. Plus, I think it's very provocative.
Joining us now to talk about the historic summit is Washington Post foreign reporter Adam Taylor. Welcome back, Adam.
Thanks for having me.
So President Trump said Tuesday that the U.S. will halt joint military exercises with South Korea as part of this larger agreement with North Korea, apparently catching South Korean U.S. military officials by surprise. For one thing, his reference to war games instead of joint military exercises. What's the significance of that?
It's certainly the language that North Korean state media would use to describe these military exercises. They do view them as a real sort of threat to them. Also, quite noteworthy was that he described them as provocative, which is definitely the language that North Korean state media uses.
So was the sense that he was just parroting what he had just heard, or what do we know about where he came up with that?
We don't know a lot about it right now, and it seems to have caught a lot of people in the Pentagon by surprise as well. It does sort of fit in with his general skepticism of, cost sharing with the U.S. military and its partners abroad. He's talked a lot about how he actually wants to get U.S. troops out of South Korea at some point in the future, and he made that reference again after the Singapore summit. So it sort of fits into his worldview as well.
Mm-hmm. That we're just doing too much for everybody else and there's not enough in it for us.
Yes, essentially. And he talked about the cost of this military exercise.
Yeah, right.
South Korea as well. I think he said something like $700 million or something like that, which when you think about the Pentagon spending overall is actually a very, very tiny fraction. But he latches onto these things, obviously.
Well, what does it mean? I mean, how does the Pentagon react after he said something like that? Do they start to cancel plans or what?
Well, he has left himself quite a lot of wiggle room. There seems to have been some confusion as well about what exercises might be canceled and which ones might not. Mm-hmm. Vice President Pence went to Congress, and I guess behind a closed door meeting was sort of talking about it. What seems to be going on is that the regular sort of training, or I think they call them readiness training, those will continue. It's the more sort of the bigger scale ones, which, do include some things like, sort of mock kind of war games, I suppose, and the real joint military exercises. Those are the things that are sort of on the table now.
There's been lots of chatter, of course, about the definitions when we refer to the idea of denuclearization. North Korea has one idea and the U.S. has another. What's the distinction so far?
The way that the actual statement that the two, Trump and Kim signed is phrased, it's incredibly ambiguous. It's a very, very short statement. As you mentioned, it says denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. That is very, very open to interpretation. It might be that the United States views it as this means North Korea gives up its nuclear weapons. It might mean that North Korea says, yes, that does mean that, but it also means that South Korea is no longer underneath the U.S. nuclear shield, nuclear umbrella, or that troops are withdrawn. It's very hard to say right now. One of the interesting things is that we are seeing sort of two sides of this coming out. The way this has been portrayed in North Korean state media is very, very different. They're sort of portraying this, particularly the halt of the military exercises, as a major concession. They also have said it would be a step-by-step process, which sort of flies in the face of what U.S. officials and Trump himself have sort of said about this.
Exactly. So this has been a big plus sign for Kim Jong-un.
Yeah, it's definitely being portrayed that way. When you look at North Korean newspapers that came out on Wednesday after the summit, it's front page news, and they're definitely not, you know, portraying this as business as usual. They're portraying this as a major, major event, but it's one that Kim is being portrayed as the one getting the concessions for.
Then, you know, the juxtaposition of the volatile G7 event in Canada, Trump's disparaging remarks about the prime minister there, and then sounding like old friends with Kim Jong-un of North Korea, who is a despot, you know, and has been known to, he's jailed more than 130,000 of his own people in concentration camps. What are people saying about that?
I saw that today the French foreign minister came out and
I didn't see that, yeah.
He said something like along the lines of, you know, look at what Trump said to Trudeau. He's attacking Trudeau, and at the same time, he's going to Singapore, and this is a quote, practically hugging dictator Kim Jong-un. Which, you know, and there's some truth to that. There was a very sort of cozy body language there. And of course, you know, it is interesting to see the U.S. president attacking probably one of the closest allies America has in the world, Canada, at the same time, just you know, hours later, going and having this incredibly sort of, not just sort of friendly, but also quite sort of substanceless discussion with North Korean's leader.
At the news conference, Trump said that the Obama administration didn't make North Korea a priority. From your reporting, was that the case?
That was sort of the tactic with the Obama administration. It was strategic patience. The whole idea was that maybe they could sort of wait out. They did implement a number of sanctions, and to an extent, the Trump sanctions that do seem to have caused some serious economic pain. They were sort of building on the prior sanctions and prior work by Obama there. But really, the idea was that, you know, they thought perhaps after the death of Kim Jong-il that North Korea actually might actually collapse, or, you know, come to the table on weaker terms. I don't think many people were expecting it to make such sort of leap and bounds in its nuclear weapons program and its missile testing that they made last year. And so to be fair to Trump, he did have to sort of deal with a very different situation than Obama or any of his predecessors.
The word patience is coming up already, though, and how the U.S. is going to have to approach this. It's going to be a long haul. There's going to have to be a lot of patience on that score with whatever comes out of this as well, right?
Yeah, of course. I mean, and the nature of what came out from Singapore is so vague that you have to assume there's going to be a lot of specifics put in terms of, you know, verification is probably the biggest one in terms of, you know, how will they verify that these nuclear sites that either are to be dismantled or have already been, you know, blown up, as in the case of the mountain which they test under in the north. You know, how will they verify that? And in that case, you know, they're saying that the sanctions won't be coming off until there's been sort of real verifiable change. So there's going to have to be a whole sort of process of removing sanctions as well. And I would imagine there'll be some sort of, some sort of economic coercion as well later down the line.
The United States made some pretty big concessions, as we've talked about. You're saying it, there was very little substance otherwise. Did the North Koreans make any concessions? Did they say they'd do anything of substance?
Well, I mean, the big thing the North Koreans have done, there's been stuff like, you know, releasing the American citizens who are being held prisoner.
Yeah.
Pretty important goodwill gesture.
And that was a few weeks ago, though.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing that we've seen come out right from the meeting itself. What actually happened really was that North Korea kind of did these sort of almost unilateral things beforehand, like blowing up the nuclear test site. And there was also this report that they've sort of dismantled the engine testing site where you test engines for sort of intercontinental missiles.
Uh-huh.
That actually appears to have happened at least a week or so ago, because satellite imagery published by the website 38 North actually caught that. Trump mentioned it. It wasn't in the statement itself, but Trump mentioned it in the press conference afterwards. You know, that is a concession. It is some sort of positive move, but it was done unilaterally, and so we don't really know the sort of context of how it was happening. And also, the way North Korea portrays it right now is that, you know, they've completed their nuclear program testing. They don't need to test it anymore. So whether that's true or not, it's a little hard to say, but that is the way it's portrayed. So they don't necessarily have to view this as concessions themselves.
What sort of timeline should we look for here?
A long one. It could take years and years. I mean, it seems, you know, we're at the stage now where even the actual details of what could be what we're working towards needs to be worked out still. And then after that, everything would have to be implemented. So, yeah, I would say years and years. The big thing I'd be watching is sort of, you know, are there going to be subsequent meetings? And actually, North Korean state media, they said that Kim had accepted an invitation to the United States and that Trump had accepted an invitation to Pyongyang. I don't know necessarily if we can trust that.
Yeah.
That isn't what the U.S. side has come out and said. But it will be interesting to see what happens next. And if there are some sort of more, the details are filled out of what's, you know, been very vague so far, I think we have to wait for the next shoe to drop. That said, you know, the way Trump tweeted about this today, he said something along the lines of North Korea is no longer a nuclear threat.
That's just not true, is it?
Well, yeah. I mean, he might be talking in terms of sort of he no longer thinks it's an adversarial relationship. There doesn't seem to be any implication that North Korea has done anything to the nuclear weapons that it already has or the missiles it already has.
And what does history tell us about the reliability of North Korea's promises at this point?
Well, there's been a few sort of similar agreements in the past. Probably the most relevant one would be the 1994 agreed framework under the Clinton administration. Later under the Bush administration, the U.S. side decided that North Korea was cheating on that and sort of going back on that. And there's a bit of debate about whether that was true or not. But certainly there seems to be a bit of kind of there's certainly evidence that North Korea isn't always very forthcoming with verification and things like that and doesn't necessarily stick to things. And that ultimately its end goal isn't, you know, to become a fully fledged peaceful member of society, but to keep the Kim dynasty in power. That said, I do wonder how different this time is. The way that North Korea is handling this is very different. Kim Jong-un flying to Singapore for a meeting with U.S. president is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And also what's a big deal is that, you know, footage of Singapore, this sort of gleaming modern city, is being shown in North Korean state media. Singapore, of course, a sort of authoritarian country that was once very poor and now is very rich. It's probably a good model for how Kim might want to take the country in the future.
Well, and that said, Donald Trump made reference to, you know, the developer and Donald Trump came out. He couldn't squelch it and said this might be a good place to build condominiums. I mean, in North Korea, you know, people. I mean, is that something that is a thing that North
yeah.
Korea really?
I mean, you know,
I've been to Korea. It's just.
It would take a long time, obviously. And they'd have to require sanctions to come off. But I'm afraid I don't have this in front of me. But like there's a South Korean construction company whose stock has risen something like 400% over the last few days because people are starting to think about this now.
Huh.
People are thinking about, okay, if Korea does open up, it's going to be a long process. But how will that happen? And you know, what are the investment opportunities?
Right, exactly. You reported on concerns from other countries about the erratic nature of U.S. foreign policy. Has this quelled or, triggered more concern this latest meeting?
I mean, I think everyone's probably happy that the sort of talk of fire and fury seems to be at least over for now. But it doesn't really fit into any sort of coherent sort of Trump foreign policy or U.S. foreign policy, and particularly when you consider the Trump pulling out of the Iran deal. I mean, it seems to be sort of two sides of the same coin, and it's hard to reconcile exactly how and why Trump would be so hard on the Iran deal and then so sort of soft on this one.
Hmm. Well, good luck with your job, Adam Taylor. And thanks for joining us today.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Adam Taylor, Washington Post foreign reporter. We will return with a couple of experts on the Korean issue. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the historic U.S.-North Korea summit that took place Tuesday in Singapore. President Trump met with dictator Kim Jong-un in talks that centered on the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. The two leaders signed a joint statement committing to denuclearization, but whether that leads to real changes remains to be seen. Others have been confused by Trump's lavish praise of Kim Jong-un.
Well, he is very talented. Anybody that takes over a situation like he did at 26 years of age and is able to run it and run it tough. I don't say he was nice or I don't say anything about it. He ran it. Very few people at that age, you can take one out of 10,000 probably couldn't do it.
Joining us now by phone from Seoul, the capital of South Korea, is Associate Professor of Politics and Government and Affiliate Professor of International Studies and East Asian Studies Programs at Ohio Wesleyan University, Dr. Ji Young Choi. Welcome back.
Thanks for calling.
Also by phone, Professor of Korean Studies at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, Sung Yoon Lee. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Many today are saying that President Trump played into Kim Jong-un's hands, that it was just a reflection of what Kim Jong-un wanted him to say. What do you think, Dr. Choi?
Yeah, I think for some people, the summit meeting legitimized a North Korean dictator, and a winner is a North Korean regime, Pyongyang. Has made efforts to gain international acceptance as a legitimate and normal state. At the summit meeting, the national flags of North Korea were placed side by side with American flags, and North Korea was seen as an equal to the United States. So North Korea has been able to achieve a certain level of international legitimacy. But in my view, Washington knows this very well and tried to meet North Korea's demands to achieve Washington's goals. Actually, President Trump repeatedly flattered Chairman Kim, saying that it was a great honor to meet with him, and Chairman Kim is really smart, and he's a very talented man, and he loves his country very much. I think he made all these comments intentionally to encourage the North Korean leader to maintain good faith with Washington and fulfill his commitment to denuclearization.
Sung Yoon Lee, what do you think?
I would say it's a complete, verifiable, irreversible dismantlement or demolition, destruction, defeat of Donald Trump by the dictator from Pyongyang.
Wow.
Completely one-sided. And it was as expected. You see, the North Korean cultish leaders, Kim the First, Second, and this one, the third generation of leader, they are so bizarre. They're so weird, so brutal. They say such outlandish, crazy things all the time that we tend to mock them. And they are endlessly mockable. If there were such a thing as an international mockability index, they would reign supreme forever. So this has implications previously and to this day. I would say every U.S. administration has underestimated and patronized the North Korean adversary, not taking them seriously. In the first days of the Korean War in 1950, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Public Policy, a man called Mr. Barrett, said of the relationship between Stalin and Kim Il-sung, the North Korean leader, grandpa, that the relationship between Stalin and Kim Il-sung is exactly the same as that between Walt Disney and Donald Duck. Kim Il-sung is not his own man. He's a mere puppet controlled by Stalin. Well, later on, many decades later, we came to learn that the war was conceived, produced, run by Kim Il-sung, and Stalin and Mao were just reluctant supporters. So we just assume that the North Korean petty dictator is either crazy or just being pulled by the bigger powers in the region. But history shows that North Korea has been defiant and independent, and the leaders have blatantly insulted, used, made fools out of Mao, Deng Xiaoping, even Xi Jinping. But China goes on supporting North Korea for strategic reasons. And Americans who have met with North Korean leaders going back to the 1970s, including New York Times reporters and high officials, they all come away uniformly impressed, dazzled by the reality that the ludicrous-looking North Korean dictator is actually not crazy, not only not a raving lunatic, but kind of attractive, reasonable, self-effacing, humble, knowledgeable. They have a sense of humor, and they're prone to saying strangely pleasing things like, yeah, you know, the U.S. troops in the region in South Korea, they will have to leave, but for now, we understand that they play a stabilizing role, so we're not calling for their immediate withdrawal. And then the outsider, the visitor, is dazzled and utterly convinced that he or she has made some deep emotional connection with a North Korean dictator by virtue of his or her own charisma and empathy. This is a fallacy, and this kind of hubris is rampant in President Donald Trump.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about and getting some reaction from a couple of experts on the U.S.-North Korea relations. You just heard from Professor Sung-Yoon Lee. He's a professor of Korean studies at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Also with us, Dr. Ji Young Choi, associate professor of politics and government, and also a professor of international studies and East Asian studies programs at Ohio Wesleyan University. Questions or comments? Give us a call. 614-292-8513. And Mark in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Mark.
Good afternoon, I think. No,
it's
still morning.
It's still morning, yep.
At any rate, Donald Trump waving around this declaration that the nuclear threat from North Korea has ended is really little different from Neville Chamberlain waving a piece of paper around saying that the threat of war with Germany is no longer exists. And I will hang up and listen.
Okay, Dr. Choi, what do you make of that?
Would you reframe the question again? What was the question exactly?
They compared the relationship between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un with like that of Neville Chamberlain and the Nazis in Germany.
Yeah, it's a very tough question.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, there are two different views. Some people are still skeptical, you know, why we have to deal with dictators and, you know, why we have to legitimize North Korea's position. But at the same time, there are different views. Actually, now I'm in South Korea, progressives and conservatives have somewhat different views. But some people believe this time North Korea is different, which means that Kim Jong-un is really interested in economic prosperity. Kim Jong-un can survive economically in spite of economic sanctions, but what he wants is not just, you know, economic survival.
Mm-hmm.
He's looking at China and, you know, Singapore and Vietnam, all these countries achieved industrialization under one-party system or authoritarian regimes. So this time, North Korea is different. Why not North Korea? But still, you know, I know that there are some skeptics, you know, there's no big difference between Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-un, and, you know, his father, Kim Jong-il. So it depends upon interpretations. For example, I know that there are more negative opinions than positive ones about the summit meeting outcomes, but I think it's too early to tell. There will be some follow-up negotiations and meetings, and so even though he's a dictator, how can you handle the nuclear crisis? North Korea has already developed nuclear weapons. So I think North Korea is de facto nuclear power.
Mm-hmm.
So in this situation, maybe the nuclear showdown is the answer. So even during the Cold War, you know, many people said that we have to negotiate with the devil. Otherwise, there is no way to resolve the issue. So in my view, we should be taking a more practical approach. I know that, you know, human rights violations.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, he is a dictator and there's other dictators out there, but there aren't many the likes of this family.
Oh, yeah. I agree that it is a totalitarian regime. It is, you know, three-generation dynasty. So it's very bizarre and, you know, outlandish regime. But, you know, if you look at history, no communist regime has been changed through really, you know, hostile policies and actually engagement policies. For example, West Germany, East Germany, for example, you know, West Germany has provided a lot of economic support as an insurance for the future, and then also globalization, you know, by opening markets. And many people say that, you know, East Germany collapsed because many people in East Germany didn't care much about politics. They wanted to buy something, some, you know, goods. And then, so that's why many experts say that engagement policy is more effective than, you know, very hostile, you know, tit-to-tat or, you know, hardline approaches have not worked out very well. So that's why I think it is time to change. And then through diplomacy, because we don't know exactly about Kim Jong-un's mind, but I think there is some silver lining, but I'm not sure we have enough time. If later, if there's any chance, I will explain more about the silver lining.
Okay. Professor Lee, do you agree there's lessons from the end of the Cold War with the Soviet Empire falling apart, with East and West Germany uniting again? Is there a lesson there for us?
There are always lessons, very pungent lessons from history. So let me give you one example. What Kim Jong-un has been doing this year, after that banner ballistic year in 2017 when he shot off three ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, and conducted a hydrogen bomb test, the most powerful nuclear test for his nation to date. And then on January 1st, Kim Jong-un dramatically changed the tune from molto agitato to placido, saying that he is now amenable to sending a delegation to the Winter Olympics held in the South, and this dramatic outreach. What is the cause? What is the reason that Kim Jong-un changed his behavior? Mm-hmm. President Trump wants to believe that he has compelled Kim Jong-un with maximum pressure and tough rhetoric, threats of military strike, and so on. I would argue all evidence actually points to the contrary. We remember that statement of fire and fury. That was made on August 8th last year. 3 weeks later, Kim Jong-un fired an intermediate-range missile over Japan on August 29th. Incidentally, although it's no coincidence, August 29th is known by all Koreans as National Humiliation Day, for it was on that date in 1910 that Japan colonized the Korean Peninsula. And Kim Jong-un actually kindly explained to everyone that this was a big middle finger for Japan. And then 5 days later, on September 3rd, Kim Jong-un conducted his most powerful nuclear test. It doesn't strike me as the behavior of a frightened man. Now, little Rocket Man or Rocket Man is on a suicide mission. That statement and total destruction, that came at the UN General Assembly on September 19th. 2 months later, which was preceded by mentally deranged, doddered, and, you know, fiery, silly rhetoric from Kim Jong-un himself, too. But in late November, Kim Jong-un fired a very powerful ICBM, which flew on a lofted trajectory, flying virtually vertically up into space. It flew 2,800 miles, which showed that Kim had the range to hit every square inch of continental United States. He made a powerful point. Again, not the typical behavior of a terrified man. So how to explain this outreach? Well, we've seen this movie repeatedly in history. Sorry to be a bit long-winded, but let me quickly give you this example. In 2000, his father, Kim Jong-il, after a period of relentless provocations, dramatically changed his tune and called on the South for the first ever inter-Korean summit. Now, that truly was unprecedented and quite exciting. But before that summit took place in mid-June, Kim Jong-il made his first foreign foray, first visit outside North Korea. And where did he go? China, of course, mm-hmm. in late May, because he had this important meeting with the South Korean coming up. So in May 2000, he met with the Chinese president. In June, he met with the South Korean president. And then in July, what happens? Putin shows up in Pyongyang. This is the first ever visit by the top Russian or former Soviet leader to North Korea ever. How is that possible? Well, because Kim had dramatically reset the table, the geopolitical chessboard. So now Kim is in a position of lining up world leaders for a series of summits. Next, United States. In October, Kim sends, this is also unprecedented, for the first time in history, a special envoy to the U.S. president, Bill mm-hmm. Clinton. This is in October. Vice Marshal Cho Myung-luk, Kim Jong-un's right-hand man, comes with a letter of invitation for Clinton to visit Pyongyang. Few people remember it today, but Clinton, just like Trump, as he did in March this year, impulsively agreed. Didn't say so right on the spot as Trump did. Mm-hmm. But Clinton was very keen on going and making history, as Trump is apparently. And 12 days later, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright is toasting Kim Jong-un's health in Pyongyang. This is quite dramatic at the time. The only reason Clinton's rushed, unprepared visit to North Korea did not materialize is not because Clinton changed his mind, but because in the wake of the November 7th presidential election in the United States, you had that fiasco vote recount between Al Gore and George W. Bush. And that was not resolved until mid-December. It was only on December 13th that Gore conceded defeat. And then you have the year-end holidays coming up.
Right.
Simply time ran out on Clinton. So my point here is one more. In January
You know what? I hate to interrupt you, but we got to take a break. We'll return. Sure. Hold the thought. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. We're talking about U.S.-North Korean summit on Tuesday in Singapore. At a press conference after the meeting, Trump talked about North Korea's future economic potential.
As an example, they have great beaches. You see that whenever they're exploding their cannons into the ocean, right? I said, boy, look at that. Wouldn't that make a great condo behind? And I explained, I said, you know, instead of doing that, you could have the best hotels in the world right there. Think of it from a real estate perspective.
Still with us by phone, Associate Professor of Politics and Government and Affiliate Professor of International Studies and East Asian Studies Programs at Ohio Wesleyan University, Dr. Ji Young Choi, and Professor of Korean Studies at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, Sung Yoon Lee. Professor Lee was just talking about this worldview of the current dictator is much in line with his predecessors. It's nothing new. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And I want to hear from Michael in Ravenna right now. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to use one word, and that word would be dismissive. And I believe that dismissiveness as a regular 56-year-old American citizen, that dismissive is the terms that the term that describes what our presidents, some of who are entertainers, business people turn presidents and things like that. They use dismissive terms like Rocket Man like crazy. They use like colors and contrast to connect to things that they relate to, like Crayola crayons, you know. But the reality is that when we come to this nuclear age with Russia back in the days and things, and how they had the Cold War with them mm-hmm. being equal to America and things.
Yeah.
Fast forward, now you have Korea, which my dad was a part of the Incheon Korea War thing. He took 3 bullets in that war, uh-huh. and he never complained. He passed away 40 years ago in a car accident, and he never got a Purple Heart. But one thing I learned from my dad is to keep walking, keep moving, and keep believing. Because if my belief was external and visual, then I would be hopeless, as certain types of Americans are.
All right. That was Michael in Ravenna. Thank you so much.
Hello?
Hello. I'm here. I'm just kind of...
Would you give me a chance to talk about the silver lining? Yeah, because we have limited time. I'd like to say a few important things, if time is allowed.
Yes, please. Go ahead, Dr. Dr. Choi.
Yeah, we should know that, of course, you know, the joint statement signed by 2 leaders lacks details on how to achieve North Korea's denuclearization and how to verify it. Moreover, it does not mention specific time frames. So the summit produced, some people believe, only symbolic outcomes, and there was nothing tangible. But we should know that tensions and hostilities between North Korea and the U.S. have continued for almost 7 decades,
mm-hmm.
and North Korea's nuclear crisis has lasted for 25 years. Only several months ago, many people worried about the risk of nuclear showdown between 2 countries. So we may have to admit that we cannot achieve many things through a one-time summit meeting. And in a sense, the summit meeting itself is a real progress, considering a history of very turbulent relations between 2 countries.
Mm-hmm.
And also there will be follow-up meetings and negotiations between American and North Korean working-level officials. They will discuss more specifics and details and how to implement the agreements. Moreover, there can be the second or even the third summit meeting in Washington or Pyongyang, depending upon those follow-up negotiations. So let's wait and see what will happen. I think it's early to tell, to conclude something. It will be a very long-term process because the Mike Pompeo mentioned that CVID so many times, but in my view, it's practically impossible to achieve CVID within 1 or 2 years. It could be a very long-term process, but right now...
Well, right, but do you think Donald Trump has the patience to do that?
Yeah, so that's why CVID is mainly publicly announced, you know, we will achieve CVID to the public, but in my view, a more realistic approach is sufficient denuclearization, for example, within 6 months, 1 year. For example, because, you know, for example, the North Korea has to scrap nuclear materials, nuclear warheads, ICBMs, shut down nuclear facilities, and also how can you handle, you know, nuclear technicians and scientists, around 1,000 technicians and scientists. So it will take a long time, but if there is some significant progress, for example, I think a real test is whether North Korea will allow any time, anywhere inspections. If North Korea allows it, I think North Korea's commitment to denuclearization is really sincere. So a more realistic approach is sufficient denuclearization within 6 months or 1 year.
I want to talk about something that happened after the president left the G7 conference in Canada. One of his aides said he needed to talk tough to Prime Minister Trudeau because he had to look tough to Kim Jong-un. And I'm wondering, is this something that's going to have to continue, if that is even the case? Sung-Yoon Lee, I mean, does the president have to take on this tough guy persona, which he seems to enjoy anyway, but be that as it may, does he have to do that? I mean, does Kim Jong-un care about that much?
No, because okay. Kim Jong-un is running the show. He's calling the tunes. In January 2001, Kim Jong-il visited China, where in China, the southern province, of Guangdong, where China has special economic zones. He was imitating Deng Xiaoping, the architect of China's reform and opening policy, and Deng actually made what was called the Southern Tour, visiting the region in 1992, visiting the cities of Guangzhou, Shenzhen, and Zhuhai, which Kim Jong-il replicated in January 2001. These were the model zones of experiment and opening in China's grand economic development program. And everyone at the time hailed the arrival of the North Korean Deng, a reform-minded dictator who was going to take the nation, his nation, on a better path of reform and opening and economic development. Just imagine the euphoria that will befall us when Kim Jong-un does the same, and he will. In the coming weeks and months, Kim Jong-un will meet with Putin. That meeting's already arranged.
Mm-hmm.
Abe, Japanese Prime Minister, has been pining for a summit meeting with Kim. Why? Because Japan's greatest concern is being left behind, being sidelined as the other neighbors are all embracing Kim, engaging him. So that's going to take place, as it did in 2002, when a Japanese head of state for the first time made a visit to Pyongyang in September 2002. So this is an elaborate process through which the funny-looking, ruthless international pariah of dictator in North Korea comes to be accepted, legitimated as not only a global statesman, but a very trustworthy, reasonable man with whom the world can do business, like nuclear business. And we heard President Trump bestow, you know, heap on this ruthless dictator whose crimes against humanity, according to the UN, have, quote, no parallel in mm-hmm. the contemporary world, end quote. Saying he's trustworthy, talented, runs his country tough, when asked about human rights, oh, yeah, you know, it's a rough situation there. But, you know, human rights, it's rough everywhere.
Yeah, you know, it's and I wanted to get to that, Dr. Choi. How do you square that? How does the United States take on normal relations with a country like North Korea, given its human rights violations?
But the problem is, how about Stalin? How about Mao Zedong? They killed thousands of people. But the United States met with them and discussed foreign issues, policies. So what is the option? If diplomacy is not an option, mm-hmm. so do we have to, there should be a nuclear showdown? Or, mm-hmm. you know, only several months ago, you know, there was real risk of warfare. So do you think we should be headed down toward direct warfare? I don't believe so.
Yeah, okay.
Of course, there are many options.
So Sung-Yoon Lee, what do you think, about that?
At the risk of being discourteous, that is a spurious argument that everyone...
You don't think that was ever a threat?
No, any criticism of Trump or any criticism of diplomacy equals war. No, I don't think so. And with respect to this...
So what is the option without diplomacy?
With view that we were on the brink of nuclear war, no, that's hyperbole. Trump, even today, and of course, one cannot take what President Trump says at face value. But he gave an interview on his way flight back, and he said, oh, he was just bluffing about fire and fury, and he felt foolish saying so. It's in Slate magazine today. Mm. Now, I don't take what he says to be the entire truth, but I think it's truer than the opposite view based on history. At no point since the end of the Korean War in 1953 has the U.S. ever shot back in the face even of lethal attacks, killings of Americans by North Korea, let alone preempt, let alone strike first. It's just not happened. Why? Because North Korea, unlike other states like Afghanistan or mm-hmm. Syria or Iraq or Libya, they have shown the capability and the intention to shoot back. And we don't want to go there. There's just simply too much on the line. And, of course, you could argue, as I would, that kind of self-restraint has helped to protect the real de facto peace in the region. No war, very much imperfect and unstable peace. But for 65 years, there has been no war in the Korean Peninsula. Whereas if you look at the 65-year period leading up to the outbreak of the war in 1950, there are four major wars that engulfed the peninsula. This is a happy equation, happy reality for South Korea that's grown very affluent and successful and free.
But what is the reaction in South Korea, Dr. Choi, to all of this?
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's too early to tell, but at least President Trump did not leave in the middle of the meeting and signed the joint document. And so it is a real progress. And of course, the role of South Korea is very important. As I mentioned, there should be follow-up negotiations and meetings, and they will discuss more specifics and details and also how to implement. And also another key issue is how to narrow down different views on denuclearization. The U.S. preferred a fast track and all-in-one approach, but North Korea prefers, you know, a phased-in or step-by-step approach. I think there should be some compromise. Maybe the Trump model should be produced, two or three short steps within a reasonable time period. And also there is another silver lining. Of course, it's early to tell, but some people believe that North Korea might pursue a de facto nuclear power status. It might shut down some of nuclear facilities and will not conduct further nuclear and missile tests, but will continue to possess some of nuclear warheads. But even though it is true, when Pyongyang is convinced that its regime security is guaranteed by Washington, this will reduce considerably Pyongyang's incentive to pursue a de facto nuclear power status. And also, even if North Korea keeps some of nuclear warheads without technical maintenance, those nuclear warheads will become useless within 10 years. So we should be able to look at this big picture, not just, you know, historical. Of course, I understand the importance of history and you know, personalities, mm-hmm. but these technical issues, we should understand these technical issues as well.
Dr. Choi, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
It's Dr. Ji-young Choi. He's Associate Professor of Politics and Government and also International Studies and East Asian Studies programs at Ohio Wesleyan University. Sung-yoon Lee, Professor of Korean Studies at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
That's it for now. There'll be more conversations ahead as we watch the relationship between North Korea and the United States, the rest of the world, unfold. You've been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.